Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Critical Theory. On this episode, I'm talking to Tina Seeker, who is a lecturer in Media and Cultural Studies at the University of Newcastle, about her new book, Climate Technology, Gender and Justice, The Standpoint of the Vulnerable, which is published by Springer Press. So welcome to the podcast.
Thank you very much.
This is an unbelievably well-timed book, considering both the media attention and the lived reality of the climate crisis that's been happening, not just in the UK, but across the world over the course of the last kind of month or 6 weeks or so. And I guess the place to start with the book is where it fits into your kind of general set of thinking and your academic career. What sort of motivated you to write the book?
I started to do a lot of work around environmental issues in my postdoc, which I did at Simon Fraser University with Andrew Feinberg, who holds the Canadian Research Chair in Philosophy of Technology. I've got a strong interest in philosophy of technology. But I started to do more and more research on sort of environmental issues, but I wanted to approach it from a different angle. And one of the things that I started to read about is, I picked up this book by Clive Hamilton on geoengineering, which he takes a kind of critical perspective, and I found it really compelling. And I thought, you know, it would be really interesting to kind of marry my interests in philosophy of technology with environmentalism, and geoengineering just struck me as something that was very odd and had an element of science fiction, but was being considered in earnest by some very significant political and economic actors. So that's sort of where what was the genesis of the project.
I mean, it's really interesting the, I guess, kind of critical take you've got around some of these, I guess, kind of technological solutions to the climate crisis. And it's probably worth kind of thinking a bit about not just the sort of technological solutions, but also the sort of current understandings of climate change and how you sketch out their limitations or their problems, particularly actually from a feminist perspective, which is one of the kind of core insights and aspects of the book.
Yeah, I found it was really interesting with a lot of the climate science that I was reading and some of the modeling that the way it was being communicated to the public and sort of the demand for, objective, rigorous, yes, no answers really didn't match up with the way the science was practiced. And I was interested in kind of seeing how scientists and science communicators were trying to balance the riskiness and the uncertainty of the science, which was fundamentally objective in the sense that it was the findings were based on scientific consensus, But then communicating that to the public was really difficult, because any space for uncertainty sort of opened the floodgates to, oh, then we don't really know. And the sort of science denialism can come in. So it was trying to really balance, you know, how do you balance uncertainty with scientific rigor? And I found that feminist science studies really did that well.
I guess there's kind of maybe three things going on there. One is the kind of the science itself. Two is the, I guess, the kind of reception and the extent to which people are involved in the reception. Then three is kind of decisions about not just kind of what is the best thing to do, but the process of taking decisions as well. And one of the things the book does is talk about the way that, in the specific case of geoengineering research, it's not just a kind of a problem for the science, but it's also a problem of methods and modeling. And it'd be quite useful, actually, if you could sketch out the kind of the geoengineering research you're engaging with and offering a critique of before we get into the kind of more detailed questions about the methods the book is interested in.
Sure. So the geoengineering, in a sort of very basic sense, I think the Royal Society has the best definition, which is it's deliberate technical intervention into the Earth's climate system. And the objective is to mitigate or moderate climate change. So the characteristics are that it's deliberate, large scale, and technological. And there are two primary methods, carbon dioxide removal and solar radiation management. I focus on solar radiation management, but just briefly, CDR is technologies that they address the root cause of climate change a little bit better, because they're actually technologies that are trying to remove greenhouse gases from the atmosphere. So something like ocean fertilization, which is a method where you seed the ocean with iron particulates, which are supposed to enhance phytoplankton blooms that absorb carbon, and the carbon then sinks to the bottom of the ocean. So that's direct removal. But solar radiation management, which I focus on, is techniques and technologies that are trying to offset increased greenhouse gas concentrations by sort of tinkering with the Earth in a way that makes it absorb less solar radiation. So the primary technology I focus on is solar radiation management that uses or kind of it mimics volcanic eruptions. And so the method is basically what they found was after large volcanic eruptions, there was a marked decrease in global average temperatures. And it was primarily because of the sulfate particulates that got into the atmosphere, which then had a reflectivity that reflected some of the sun's rays back into the atmosphere. And so it was thought that, you know, if we could see the atmosphere with these, or the stratosphere actually, with these sulfate particulates, then potentially we could mimic those cooling effects so that we could increase the albedo of the Earth, the reflectivity, so that we could, you know, actually have some global cooling.
I mean, it's a really good example of the issues the book is grappling with, because immediately, you know, you're drawn to both almost the kind of science fiction element of that, and, you know, various kind of popular sci-fi films have talked about these kinds of processes. And then also, you know, the technical elements, this is quite an opaque and difficult to follow area of science, but the fact that it includes basically every single person and indeed all of the rest of the Earth in terms of how decisions are going to be made. And I wonder if you could sort of stake out the sense of a feminist kind of critique, not just of those processes, but of the kind of where the climate change debate is in general at the moment.
Yeah. So for geoengineering, I mean, it's a an area of research where there's not a lot of feminist analysis. I think there's one article that is out there that tries to do a feminist analysis, and it focuses a little bit on the science itself. I think it's actually called Gender and Geoengineering. It focuses a little bit on the lack of representation of women in climate science as well as in geoengineering, and the way that the science itself represents a kind of masculine hierarchical model of science, big technology, which is problematic in the kind of ways that it sees the Earth, in that it kind of replicates a lot of the assumptions that have led to the climate crisis in the first place. In terms of where it is, there's not a lot of feminist analysis of geoengineering specifically, but there is a whole host of actors, private, academic, policy, government, that are pushing to have more research in geoengineering. And so the biggest actors are people like David Keith, who's a Harvard physicist, Ken Caldera, who's at Stanford. Marcia McNutt is one rare woman who is an oceanographer that works a little bit on geoengineering. Royal Society has done a report, National Academy of Sciences, NASA, the IPCC in their fifth report called for more research. A lot of private think tanks, interestingly enough, have held research forums and conferences on geoengineering, and ones that, very ironically, had, they still hold climate denialism as their fundamental position on climate change, but have sort of skipped over the step of accepting it to embrace geoengineering as a possible solution, like the American Enterprise Institute, Hudson Institute, Heartland Institute, and Bill Gates, a lot of billionaires, Richard Branson. Corporations haven't done a ton except in backing research. And I think it's important to note that David Keith at Harvard is on hoping to run a trial in Arizona of the geoengineering, the sulfate geoengineering, that's sort of my area. A lot of opposition to geoengineering. Clive Hamilton, who's a professor in Australia of public ethics, Alan Robach at Rutgers, the Etc. Group, which does a lot of research online, which is a sort of NGO. So there's a lot of work being done. The British Parliament and the Congress a few years ago did a joint sort of congressional and parliamentary panel where they did a lot of, called in sort of experts to put together a report on geoengineering, including people like David Keith. So there is a lot of work and a lot of movement to have trials and tests. There was a test that was supposed to happen a few years ago in the UK called the SPICE project, but there was opposition to it, and there were some problems with funding, I believe, so it never really took off. But Oxford still has a geoengineering group that looks at sulfate geoengineering specifically.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I mean, it did strike me as just kind of incredibly crazy that you're almost more likely to see a think tank that's been heavily involved in denying that climate change is happening or, you know, producing evidence to kind of muddy the waters than you are to see a woman's voice in any of these debates, both as, you know, a kind of advocate policymaker or as, you know, someone sort of offering a critical perspective. And obviously this, you know, opens up feminist critique really, really kind of straightforwardly, actually, in it. You know, it's an area that in the kind of the need for a feminist approach is so clear. And you've got a kind of specific, I suppose, approach and take, which you call feminist contextual empiricism, drawn from Longino's work. And it'd be great to hear a bit about what that kind of specific approach is, and how you've kind of found it or come to it as the right way of getting into these questions about who is represented and who isn't in geoengineering.
Yeah, sure. I came to feminist contextual empiricism and Longino's work beginning with an interest I had in ecofeminism. Some of the concerns I had with ecofeminism, you know, this idea that you know, the marginalization of women and nature sort of are inextricably linked, or the oppression of women and nature have these sort of similarities, structural similarities. And I found that ecofeminism, one of the things I was concerned with was that it essentialized femininity in ways that I was uncomfortable with when it came to science in particular. And I sort of sought out to look at, you know, what are some other approaches to science rooted in feminism that could account for scientific practice in ways that didn't do that. And I taught a course on gender and science at Simon Fraser University, because I'm originally from Canada. And I ended up teaching a course. And through my research for that syllabus, I came across standpoint theory, Sandra Harding's work. I taught on technofeminism. And then I came to sort of get in the area of feminist epistemology more specifically. And I found that feminist contextual empiricism did a really useful job of retaining the scientific rigor, you know, the empirical adequacy, the scientific method, in ways that were, you know, rigorous and scientific and grounded in empiricism, but that also considered how values and background assumptions and norms were an inextricable part of scientific practice as well. And so kind of, you know, holding those two together, that science could be value-laden, but also be rigorous. And how could you, you know, create a kind of tension between the two? And Longino's work, I really found I was drawn to because it could do that.
I mean, within it, there is the kind of proposition that you can do kind of good science, and this has a set of characteristics or criteria, and that is very much actually the kind of the rest of the book, you know, where you're sort of considering how geoengineering is being done and whether it fits or comes up to these sorts of standards. And maybe we might take them in turn, actually, because what the book does is offer not just the kind of critique of where we are with geoengineering, but also I think some guidance on what could be done differently to make it better, you know, to improve it, rather than just kind of saying, oh, it's a big problem, you know, and it sort of can't be solved. And I guess the first aspect is this term ontological heterogeneity. And I wonder if you could sort of unpack that, but also talk about how it tells us things about who gets included and who gets excluded as well in the current geoengineering approach.
Sure. So ontological heterogeneity is one of the contextual values in science that Longinot argues we need to embrace. And there's a lot of trepidation that, you know, this idea that heterogeneous science that's too open is problematic because that is inimical to scientific rigor. And so what it is and how it applies to kind of geoengineering in particular, it's a mode of scientific practice that focuses on how science itself should be participatory, that it should be open to difference, that marginal findings shouldn't be considered inferior or eliminable, that monocausal and unicausal thinking are actually not good science. So when you would apply it to geoengineering, you would kind of look at the practice of science itself and ask questions around, you know, why do we, sort of put the global temperature averages over local specificities in order of importance. So, you know, why don't we look at specific effects of geoengineering? One of the potential negative effects is that it could lead to problems with the ozone, that it could mess up monsoons over Southeast Asia. Why is it that we look just at CO2 concentrations? What about methane? The models also don't do a good job of looking at the distribution of impact, so different economic sectors, responsibility. And it's this idea that heterogeneity doesn't dilute scientific focus. I think that even the ways in which a heterogeneous science can get into issues of politics, where, you know, the urban versus rural binary that's in a lot of the models is assumed, is Eurocentric. It reflects the colonial history where effects in the global north tend to be prioritized over the global south. You know, why is it that we don't look at producers versus consumers in terms of responsibility? So, you know, paying attention to deviations, model disagreement, different time scales, that all of these things are practices in science that should be embraced rather than denied, which is something that a lot of sort of traditional science does.
And what about novelty, which is the next of the important criteria?
Yeah, so novelty is another contextual value. It's sort of the relationship between theory and explanation. And it's interesting because you could make the argument that geoengineering is novel. Because, you know, it has sort of, it's really exciting. It's media highlights this quite a bit. It's interdisciplinary. The intercomparison projects are really sort of compelling as well. But there's a difference, I think, between being technically innovative and being novel the way that Longinot understands it. And so novelty in climate science and geoengineering science is more about the practice of science. So, you know, using local data sets would be something that's very novel. It's not used very much. Experiential knowledge, biodiversity. I was really interested in some research that's done on paleoecology, which looks at you know, it could look at how solar geoengineering might impact how organisms interact with the environment through time. Biological, geological evidence, you know, not just models that are based on physical science, but embodied knowledge. One thing I found really compelling as well for solar geoengineering was aesthetics, where one of the side effects could be that our skies could turn very white. And the lack of blue skies could have a very sort of psychological effect on people, which, you know, is really interesting also. And then issues of gender, race, and class, how these different sort of intersecting groups are going to be affected in very different ways. Some of the most dangerous side effects of climate change around the monsoons, for example, are going to impact the poorest over Southeast Asia, you know, with droughts and floods. And that is sort of mentioned in the geoengineering research, but it isn't really grappled with.
I mean, what you're pointing to there is the importance of kind of power and power relationships. And I found that really quite compelling in the book, the sense of, you know, we unfortunately have this approach to dealing with climate change and the climate crisis, which takes really kind of no account of the uneven power relations that are present here. And I guess within that, there's also a kind of a sense of what the benefits are going to be and how they're, I suppose, distributed. So it'd be interesting to hear about this kind of problem of power relationships that Longino is kind of drawing our attention to.
Yeah, in terms of power, I mean, there's a lot to be said about how, you know, you can look at different sort of areas or spaces where power is present. And one of the biggest ones is in the effects where, you know, that the monsoons I mentioned, ocean acidification, in terms of impact on people, because it is going to be the case that the most problematic effects of side effects of solar geoengineering is going to be felt by the people who are already marginalized. I think that another one, you know, even just considering the idea of monsoons, looking at in a granular way, you know, if there is going to be a increase in monsoons or drought over Southeast Asia, you know, it is going to be people who are poor, who are agricultural, women, there's going to be displacement, you know, all of these types of things, food security. And the people who are going to be deciding to implement geoengineering, I think, you know, are obviously going to be people in the global north. So it's reconstituting these colonial relationships. And, you know, there's going to be this sort of migration of people that comes out of it. And you know, our particularly in the West, our current approach to displacement due to conflict or poverty or climate change has not been good at all. So I think that kind of disempowerment, the lack of decision-making power of people who are going to be impacted, I think it's a real problem. And I think that the way that the science is occurring in the private sector, away from public scrutiny, it's very complicated science, that it is cheap science. So, you know, putting sulfate into the atmosphere is something that is not necessarily difficult to do on a scale that, you know, it is possible for countries to decide to do it, that the power over decision-making is really in a few hands. And I think even issues of intergenerational justice is a problem, because if you start geoengineering, solar geoengineering, One of the other side effects is that if you stop abruptly, temperature increases are thought to be, you know, going to be observed as quite rapid. And then what does this do for the ability of future generations to make decisions? And I think all of that really kind of coalesces around this idea that it is a very hierarchical science that requires centralized decision-making in ways that replicate the extractive scientific practices of the past that have given rise to the problem of climate disruption and climate change. And I think that those issues around power have to be considered in more detail, and they haven't been thus far.
And how would we do a kind of a response to the crisis that took human needs and human capabilities more seriously?
Yeah, I think that, you know, taking and doing an analysis of the science through this kind of feminist analysis is very helpful. But I think also, you know, thinking about the Earth, I mean, another one of the models is around diffusion of power. But, you know, thinking about the Earth as an independent system that, you know, has feedbacks, that is an agent, is one way we can start to do that. So, you know, looking at Earth systems as constituted agents. So this idea that it's not just about us exerting power over nature, you know, how we construct the natural world as an object of knowledge and how we've sort of looked at it as something that could be exploited, that has to change. One of the interesting things that I found in the research I did was, you know, countries that have started to give the natural world a legal status. So the Ganges River in India or Ecuador has done this as well, where, you know, it is a moral agent. And I think that, you know, the idea of the Anthropocene gets us closer. I sort of have a relationship to the idea of the Anthropocene that's a little kind of contradictory, because I think that it is an idea that gets us closer to thinking about the ways in which our actions have led to climate disruption. But it also can reify this idea that we have power over nature and propel us towards more technical solutions. So this idea of the techno-Anthropocene. And I think that, you know, taking those actions and looking at issues of social responsibility, scientific practices that are, you know, inclusive and empowering, looking at the metaphors we use to talk about our relationship with the natural world. I think all of those things are ways in which we can use feminist science to do better science and to perhaps look at climate mitigation strategies that are not premised, you know, scientifically in terms of epistemology and ontology, on models and values and approaches that are consistent with how we've always done things and sort of are taking it to, you know, a kind of laughable extreme in some cases.
And at the same time, actually, the book closes with a reflexive moment that, you know, kind of suggests that even feminist contextual empiricist approaches might be improved, maybe, or kind of further developed. And I was really interested to see actually that moment where the book had got this critical engagement with a set of scientific practices, but then in turn closed with its own critical reflections. And maybe, you know, obviously standpoint theory and techno-feminism are the two sets of ideas, which they themselves, you know, have a kind of a sort of long literature and history associated with them. But maybe as a way of closing, you might kind of reflect on perhaps the limits of feminist contextual empiricism.
Yeah, I think that it's always important when, you know, you're drawn to a particular approach to retain that element of critical analysis, where you look at how it can be improved or what other models or frameworks can offer to it. And I've found that, you know, I kind of like feminist standpoint theory because it is more radical. And, you know, standpoint theory, I think it takes this idea that, you know, looking at the empirical part of feminist contextualist empiricism and saying, you know, maybe even that empiricist element is too positivist or too endocentric. And, you know, highlighting the idea that knowledge that emerges from marginalized communities, you know, that science from below is inherently better because it sort of speaks directly to issues of power, injustice, race, class, privilege, and sort of saying that knowledge from those spaces of marginalization, you know, embodied indigenous knowledge, is a priori better, more objective knowledge. And I think it's just sort of worth considering what that would look like and how that is justified. And perhaps taking even the empirical element of feminist contextualist empiricism and looking critically at it is, at least in terms of an analytic exercise, something that is really important. And then techno-feminism, I like because it draws attention to the relationship not only with science, but with the technology and the issue of design. You know, looking at the idea of gender and technology as mutually constituted so that, you know, gender relations are reflected in technologies and that technologies in turn shape gender relations, that technologies are not neutral. They're shaped by intentions, and it sort of draws our attention to this idea that perhaps we can shape technologies in progressive ways. And so the idea of women being involved in science is not just about them being there as sort of placeholders, but this idea that they can shape technologies in ways that reflect different values, different social values that are not values that they have because they are women, but because they have experienced very specific manifestations of marginalization that have made it so that they can speak to issues that other groups can't. And so I think that Longinot talks about how to do science, not feminine science, but doing science as a feminist. So that there's nothing innate about the values of science that are feminine, but there is something that comes out of feminist practice that is a result of historical marginalization and shared experiences that draws women's attention to certain issues that are not looked at by groups that are not women. And, you know, then you have standpoint theory being a little bit more intersectional about this. You have techno-feminism drawing attention to issues of design of technology that I think, you know, sort of ties everything together really well.
Are those kind of critical moments something you're going to be working on in the future? Are you doing more kind of STS approaches to climate change from a feminist perspective, or have you had quite enough of reading long kind of complex technical scientific manuals, and are you going to be moving on to something else?
I'm still working on this. I did another, you know, I've done some work on sort of looking more at intersectional scientific practice and geoengineering, but yeah, my primary interest is in feminist science studies. So, you know, sticking with that, but I've also done some work around food science, nutritional science, looking at nutrigenomics. So, you know, sort of nutritional science based on analysis using feminist science studies of nutritional science and assumptions around what makes food, how do we use science to reach the conclusion that, X food is healthy and Y food is not. And so sort of applying similar frameworks to look at diet, to look at health science, to look at public policy around health, which is, something I'm doing some work on as well.
And are you doing a book on that or a series of papers, just a big research project?
Yeah, I'm actually looking to put together a project around superfoods in particular. So looking to put together a book. I'm working on a book proposal for a feminist science-based analysis of superfoods that would draw attention not only to scientific practice, but issues of power, of access, of food security as well. I'm actually going this weekend to London for a research group on food security and food justice that is really looking at the practice of science. And so hopefully some connections can be made there for a research project looking at, approaches to food and nutrition that might incorporate a feminist dimension to it.